Hello there, and a warm welcome to this, the 266th edition of DF Direct Weekly, our weekly show discussing the latest gaming and technology news. Lots to get through this week. Joining me, first of all, Oliver McKenzie. Hello.
Yes, Rich, always a pleasure. Always so much fun. Always a great time to talk to the two of you, of course, on this fine program.
And I'm sure he's ready with yet another visual reference that will not be appreciated by our audio podcast audience. It's John Linneman.
Well, this time I felt the warmth of that welcome, Rich, and it's almost like the warmth of the fury that Tim Sweeney unleashed upon Gabe Newell over his yacht. So the billionaires are fighting, Rich.
Wow. I didn't see that coming. I thought Gabe had repurposed his yacht into some sort of scientific exploration vessel.
Maybe. I haven't kept up on Gabe's yacht, but...
Okay, enough of this foolishness. Let's get straight on with the episode. Okay, so our first news story of the week, and it's kind of shocking, remarkably so, in fact. Valve Steam Deck has been out of stock for quite some time. Obviously, a victim of the memory and storage issues that we're having to put up with at the moment. But it was back, or rather it was back for a very, very short time because it went out of stock again very, very quickly. But the shock here is that the price of the Steam Deck OLED rate was raised significantly. US prices here, 512 gigabyte model went up to $789, up from $549. $240 increase. Man, that's not great. The 1 terabyte model, it now costs $949, up from $649. That's a $300 increase. Shocking stuff. Oliver, I want to go to you first on this one because, man, I mean, we were kind of expecting something, right?
Right.
But, price rises in excess of 40% is staggering.
Yeah, it's shocking, and I kind of wonder if the price rises, and as weird as this is to say, possibly should have been a little bit higher, because they did sell out in like 24 hours, which is quite staggering for the new stock of the console, because I think that, at least in the US and Canada, they've been out of stock for about a year now. Perhaps they've intermittently been back in stock since then in other regions, but it's been a pretty dire situation. And yeah, to have like 44%, 45% price rises, it's like shocking the extent of the price rises. And it's a huge concern, obviously, for gamers who do want to get into Steam Deck, because Steam Deck historically has been a bit of a value play as a handheld, especially relative to the other entrants in this space. Like, it's been the cheapest device. It's been a device with maybe some lower specs in certain key areas, a lower fidelity processor, a worse screen in terms of resolution, at least. So it's a little awkward, and especially it's awkward against Switch 2, which is like $450 USD. It'll be $500 USD in a few months, but that's a much better price than $789 for a comparable Steam Deck. It's just ridiculous. Obviously, the culprit is AI data center use here for these various components and the kind of retooling of semiconductor manufacturing towards these kind of large-scale industrial uses. But it's interesting here that Valve has increased their prices so much. I think probably one large factor, to avoid the pun, is that Valve is a small player in this field. So when Nintendo or Sony or even Asus or Lenovo, when they buy out production facilities and when they buy out massive supply chains and whatever, they're buying, you know, potentially multi-year contracts now. They're buying millions and millions of units. They are making massive, massive inroads into these production facilities, and Valve is just not able to do that. Valve is not a small company by any means, but the scale of their hardware business is a lot smaller than those of their vendors. And then factor B, I suspect that Valve is just not willing to subsidize production that much, or at least they're not willing to anymore for whatever reason. In part because, like, you know, they are a platform holder, but Valve can make their money off Steam no matter who your hardware vendor happens to be, right? I'm sure they're going to sell a ton of Steam games on any PC platform, whereas with like Nintendo or Sony, they really have to sell you their blade to sell you the Razors, right? Whereas Steam does not need to sell you their specific hardware. They will do just fine if other competitors sell their devices through to consumers, I suspect, because the vast majority of digital game sales will be on Steam regardless. But ultimately, I think that, like, I don't know, there's probably a case to be made that pricing is not high enough here because they sold, like, selling it in 24 hours and leaving the market to scalpers doesn't feel great, but increasing prices by this margin also doesn't feel great. So I don't know that Valve is in a great position here necessarily. Because clearly, like even at this really high price, they can't satisfy demand, whether that's because the demand is just pent up over so much time or whatever. I mean, it's just a ridiculous situation. And then I would also suggest this portends very poorly for Steam Machine, because Steam Machine has more RAM than Steam Deck. It has potentially more storage than Steam Deck on that higher end SKU. If you're increasing prices by 50% on the Steam Deck, or closest to 50% relative to premium prices, what does that mean for a Steam Machine that is, you know, even worse positioned? So yeah, these are all big concerns. I don't know. It's just kind of a dire situation for any kind of consumer hardware in this space. But for Valve in particular, it seems to be hitting them hard, harder than other vendors potentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, John, what do you think about the what we should expect to see from Steam Machine at this point? Because it's going to be subject to the same problems, right? Obviously, the cost of memory is skyrocketed, and the cost of storage likewise. So, I mean, this isn't looking great. I mean, you know, the memory on Steam Machine, 24 gigs versus the 16 in the deck, it's going to be challenging, right?
Yeah, I'm very concerned about this as well, because there was some theories floating around that by increasing the price of Steam Deck, Valve is essentially cushioning the blow for when they inevitably announce the price for the Steam Machine and I guess the Steam Frame, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like, okay, just expect high prices. And as Oliver noted, and I was thinking as well, it's like, I don't think Valve is willing to take that loss on the hardware, as we see with the other console manufacturers, because it is not the only method to access the storefront, right? Which almost feels like this whole RAM crisis and storage crisis has put into jeopardy what seemed like Valve making a strong push to compete at a lower level, perhaps, but, you know, really sort of get into this, like, handheld console space, right? Like, there's only like 5 million something Steam Decks out there, right? Like, right, they were never going to compete with the Switch, but it's still, it's not like the Switch, because it's just like one way to access the Steam marketplace. And now that the prices are so high, it just feels like they're going back to essentially accepting that, you know, this will remain a very niche product. And I think that's, right, unfortunately what's going to happen with the Steam Machine at this point. If they had managed to get the Steam Machine down to like $500, I think that would have been a gigantic hit, like huge. People want something like that, a small form factor PC that's actually nice looking, that's genuinely small form factor that you can just hook up to your TV and use like a console. I think that would have been brilliant. But at the price they're going to have to hit instead, I just don't see how that's going to happen. And it almost feels like they're just going to have to release this as a niche device and accept the fact that, yeah, it's an expensive product now. And I do wonder if the Steam Deck being out of stock for so long is also just a function of Valve sort of trying to wait things out, you know, just to see, right, if the prices do course correct. But then they obviously did not. And they essentially said, well, we got to get it out there at some point, I guess, and went ahead and did that. But it's just yet another symptom of this whole AI bubble just having a seriously negative impact on hardware in general, consumer hardware, and it's really putting into jeopardy the future of ownership of anything, it feels like, right? I mean, when you see people like Jensen out there talking about how the future is like, yeah, you don't have to use your computer anymore, you have AI agents that use your computer for you, like, what's even the point? That sounds like a nightmare. Like, I don't want to hear these leaders saying stuff like that. That's one of the least appealing things I could ever imagine. Like, there is no world would I ever want that. And it really feels like they just want to slowly take hardware away from us, put the genie back in that bottle, and, like, they sell you services and server space as opposed to actual machines. And these gigantic price increases are just going to push people in that direction, it feels like.
I think, you know, the issue with that is that the concept of the sheer scale of the infrastructure they need to build to do that is like staggering.
Oh, I agree, but they clearly want to move in that direction, right?
I don't know, because, you know, what do you think, Oliver?
Well, I wouldn't want to speculate too much about that. I think that, like the price rises in general, consumer hardware that are outside of the gaming sphere, have been more reasonable. I think when you look at like Apple's price increases, for instance, Apple being possibly the PC manufacturer with the most individual purchasing power in the world, their price increases basically absorbed price increases by cutting out low-end models, right? So instead of selling you the 256 gig model, they sell you the 1 terabyte model and they sell it for $200 more, but that would have been their standard upgraded pricing anyways. It's just their margins happen to be better in that product. I think that there's just a concern in general about scarcity, though, because you look at the Apple situation. I've not talked about this in DF Direct, but it's been something on my mind over the past few months. And you can't currently buy an Apple desktop computer with good specs because they're just out of stock of all the Mac Studios. Like, I can't buy a Mac Studio even if I wanted to with over 96 gigs of memory, which might sound like a lot, but like Mac Studios have shipped with up to 512 gigabytes of memory. Those models are completely unavailable, or they've been backordered so much that they don't even let you purchase them anymore. Like, it's a really bad situation. I'm not sure what it means about like long-term price increases, though, or like what it means about the future of computing, because I do expect the price increases probably to settle down. At least that's what analysts have been projecting, and the supply shortages to ease a little bit over the coming months. But it's definitely a major concern in a world where especially small PC players like Valve are just getting like iced out of the industry because they're exposed to like spot prices, I think, or spot-like prices, much more than someone like Apple is, who buy like, you know, multi-year contracts.
Right.
So yeah, I think it's a big problem in that space for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the pricing of the handheld in particular on the Steam Deck side is it's somewhat uncompetitive because obviously at the same time you can still remarkably pick up a Xbox Rog Ally X for like $1,000, which doesn't have that fantastic screen, but does have VRR, does have a much better processor, does have 24 gigs of memory, does have a 1 terabyte SSD, I believe.
Yeah.
So, that we're in that sort of weird situation where I guess Valve is kind of like a victim of being a relatively smaller player in this hardware space and can't secure the kind of supplies of memory that somebody like ASUS can. But, you know, where do we go from there? Does ASUS say, whoa, hold on a minute, we've got the opportunity here to actually raise the prices based on what Valve has done? They were effectively the baseline in the past. It's really, really concerning. And I think there are genuine concerns at this point about, in the sort of mid to high end, I think people who operate in that kind of price range are still going to buy. I think it's more to the lower end that I'm more concerned about at this point where, you know, things are super, super tricky there.
Yeah.
Quite difficult now to build a PC. I think the used market is actually going to become a lot more important. Even there is price inflation. I'm just talking about my personal experience at this point, but the consoles actually don't seem to have been that radically affected by the price increases on like Facebook Marketplace or whatever. You can still buy used consoles at a relatively decent price. But obviously it's not quite the same, is it? You know, you don't know the history of the device. You don't know if there's going to be issues with it further on down the road. There's no warranty, that kind of thing. The same thing's happening on PC, of course. Stuff that was super, super cheap in the past is now no longer super cheap.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really, really tricky situation. I think that we're reaching the point now where there could be long-term damage, basically. I think that's the bottom line, certainly in terms of like expanding the audience. And if you're not expanding the audience, then, all of those hundreds of millions of dollars going into games, that's going to end badly. It's a cycle of potential disaster, I think.
The one thing I would want to say on that, Rich, is that there's already like, what, nearly 100 million PS5s out there. Over 100 million Switch 1s. You know, the Switch 2's built mm-hmm. up a sizable audience. There's a good amount of Xboxes out there. Tons and tons of devices capable of playing PC games. Like, the hardware is already in the hands of so many people. I think what this means for now is that we're just going to have to rely on existing owned hardware, right? And so companies should basically continue to target what is currently on the market as opposed to thinking forward with new hardware and new consoles. Because that's going to be a problem, launching a new console at this point. Yikes.
Yeah. I also wonder if the move here is maybe for someone like Valve to partner with companies that are more able to secure supply, because when you look at devices like the Lenovo Legion Go S, which runs SteamOS, that's still in the on sale, like the at least Z2 Go edition with the VanGo processor, for like $500 or $600. I've seen it going at various outlets in the United States, which seems like a totally reasonable price. And I don't know if that's just legacy stock that hasn't been repriced to affect the availability, to reflect the availability of the components. But it's potentially one avenue for Valve to go down here as they try to navigate this market. And ultimately, like, Valve is a big value add. I mean, the Steam Machine is great hardware and the Steam Deck is great hardware. But I do think their ultimate value add relative to other PC makers is SteamOS. And SteamOS is something that they can run on many partner devices, right? So that aspect of their value add is something that could be easily scaled to many millions of partner devices if they felt like that was appropriate.
One interesting thing, man, is back in September of last year, there was this period where you could buy the Steam Deck LCD for like $319 on the Steam right, store.
Yes.
And it's like the cost of that is not much more than the actual increase in price for, say, the 1 terabyte model here, right? Which is just wild to think about. And yes, I know it's the Steam Deck LCD, and that LCD is worth like negative money, but still, it's a good way to get into the Steam Deck if you don't care about, you know, using a really horrible display.
I like this concept of negative money, John.
Yeah, I mean, I say that because it's so bad that you would have to pay me to use it. Like, I wouldn't I would never use an LCD like that by choice. Essentially, I really think it's that bad, and I'm being slightly hyperbolic here just for fun, but you know, I thought that screen, man.
Right.
But still, it was a good, it was actually a good value at $319. Right. That was crazy.
Yes, you can actually see it. I mean, that does suggest there is some value to that LCD.
Correct.
It does work.
It does actually work.
Let's round off the segment by coming up with our price suggestions or you know, predictions, so to speak, for the Steam Machine in its 512 gig and 2 terabyte forms. John,
oh my god, I really don't know, man. This is so difficult. I mean, I really think if they cross the $1,000 mark on any of these, like, it's a disaster.
Right.
I'll just say, and now for the 2 terabyte model, maybe, sure, but the entry can't be over $1,000. If it is, like, may as well just cancel the Steam Machine.
Okay. What do you think, Oliver?
I think, geez, maybe $1,000 for the base model. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe $1,200 for the 2 terabyte. I mean, it kind of depends. That's where the pre-built market is trending in that direction at the moment. Maybe you can get some deals a little bit cheaper than that. But I don't know what Valve's supply timelines look like or their release timelines indeed for Steam Machine. They said first half of this year, but I suspect they're going to be pricing it with an eye to keep that price at a stable level long term.
I think that they're going to be challenged, obviously, in terms of securing memory and storage. There is, I think, the possibility that there might be some sort of potential for a sweetheart deal with AMD for the GPU and the CPU side of things. I want to be optimistic here and say 800. I could be mad here. Wow. 800 for the base unit, 1,000 for the 2 terabyte. I think I'm going to be disappointed though. But I think that price would fly. But I think the other thing, of course, at this point is that if they can sell out of a Steam Deck at 1,000, you know, basically $950, then they can basically set whatever price they want for the Steam Machine. I think at this point, I think that's the bottom line. I think if it is a niche model with a lower production run, which I think is probably likely to be imposed on them, then that's more likely the thing that's going to happen. It's a bit of a shame. I completely neglected the supporter questions on this, but let's quickly run through them. Kenny Powers, with the Steam Deck price increases, are we cooked? Potentially, I think is the answer to that based on the discussion we just had. Avi asks, given the staggering price increase we just saw with the Steam Deck, what do you think this means for the cost and release of the Steam Deck and Steam Frame? While I do enjoy my Steam Deck OLED, if I were in the market now, I would absolutely not spend that kind of money on one. Thing is, Avi, clearly other people will. And if you've got a low production run, then, you know, it's who knows what the price is going to be. Eric Benoit asks, can any price be predicted on the PS6 or Xbox Helix from a $300 price increase on the Steam Deck OLED? Seems like things are getting worse, much worse, before they get better. If anyone needs me, I'll be in the fifth and sixth generation. Ta-ta and farewell, Eric Benoit. I think it's a completely different series of economics for Microsoft and Sony, who've got like massive buying power. The question is the extent to which other people have got massive buying power and might outbid them for those memory and storage components. it's super, super tricky out there. Okay, let's move on. Right then, so we've already produced our coverage for the console versions of 007 First Light. Oliver, you looked at the PlayStation 5 and Pro versions, and you're currently looking at the Xbox versions. That should be coming very, very imminently. We'll be talking mm-hmm. about that disparity in release dates on various formats in a segment later on. PC version, though, I went into this one expecting good things. To a certain extent, I'm impressed. To other extents, I'm not quite so impressed. But John, you've been looking at this one also, but you have kind of like the benefit of effectively throwing infinite GPU power at the problem in a game that actually seems to be quite optimized CPU-wise. So why don't you share your impressions of kind of like the top-end 007 First Light PC experience?
Oh, yeah. Coming from our last conversation, it feels kind of weird now talking about this, right? It's the high-end experience, because most people aren't going to get that. But I did look at it both on the high-end and, well, the Steam Deck. And okay. It's interesting. So obviously the high-end experience is perfectly fine, I would say. Like, it's what you would hope and expect. And it's a case where I was able to enjoy it with DLAA at 5120 by 2160 mm-hmm. wow. without any issues. Like, I was genuinely like, it was like fine. It was really only once I started to read impressions on less capable machines that I saw like, oh wait, there's some issues here. And sure enough, like the DLSS scaling portion doesn't, DLAA works, but the scaling portion of DLSS doesn't really seem to work correctly. And it's only got like old FSR 3 XESS without the frame gen stuff. Like, it's weirdly limited on that front, which is kind of odd. But I will, even on the high end experience, there is one small complaint I have, and that's the weird 21 by, or yeah, I guess ultra wide support. Like, I understand okay. ultra wide is not like everywhere, right? It is still niche, but the game itself supports it well. But the cutscenes, even though the cutscenes are also ultra wide, they display in a tiny little centered box in the middle of the screen, right? So it's like okay. a 16:9 image with an ultra wide frame around it. So you get giant black bars all around the cutscenes, and then it expands when the game starts. And I think that really sucks, like, for a cinematic game. Like, I suspect it has to do with the transition between cutscene and gameplay, but I feel like they could have come up with something for that, because they clearly put the time in for ultra-wide support, because even the video stuff seems to support that. It's just all the real-time cutscenes are, like, little tiny boxes, and I don't get it. So that sucks, but aside from that, high-end experience, it is what you'd hope, right? No, nothing to complain about. Steam Deck, if you cap it at 30 FPS and you use kind of this like a mix of like lower and medium settings, I found that you can actually get something that is actually quite good. It's quite convincing on the Deck. And that was using, I guess, I was using FSR for sure. I forget mm-hmm. what setting, but I felt like it looked good on the Deck, is the point, considering the hardware, right? Like, it's obviously cut down compared to what we see on the consoles, but it still suitably looks like Bond. And at 30 FPS with the blur and everything, I think it looks pretty all right. I can't say that it maintains 100% lock throughout based on my testing. I think some people were getting over, like, reasonably over it, but I do think it's better just to cap it at 30 and be done. You know what I mean? Yeah. And... Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the Deck, I think that made me think like, hey, okay, low end PCs can have a pretty good experience, actually, given that the Steam Deck is very low end, but in the PC space. But Rich, you've been doing some testing and found that it's more like the middle ground is getting an experience that seems a lot less good than it should be, considering the hardware. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically, it's there's a lot going on here, basically. I think the thing to bear in mind is that when you're dealing with hardware like an RTX 4060, which is what I first tested on, right, the compute power there is kind of ballpark to a current generation console. It's sort of there with the 2070 Super, which Alex used to use to compare to consoles.
Right.
And we would expect to get an experience kind of like consoles. And all the more so, bearing in mind that IO Interactive rather generously supplied us with this table, which shows all of the equivalent settings for all of the consoles, right?
Ooh.
So, you know, you're looking at stuff like, you know, texture quality, high, 8x AF, medium level of detail, high terrain quality, you know, all of this sort of stuff. You were right, Oliver, just about the only difference in terms of quality settings between PS5's performance and quality mode is indeed the shadow quality,
right,
where it's kind of like medium plays ultra. Everything else is much the same, and DRS is essentially taking the role of the heavy lifting there in terms of like stabilizing performance. Now, on the PC side of things with the RTX 4060, I immediately dialed in the PS5 performance mode settings. Why not? Because I want 60 frames per second. But there are issues here, right? The issue starts with the fact that the upscaling on via DLSS is not working properly. So I've got some numbers here from a particular scene, which I tested. You know, I tested all of the 1440p on the 4060. I tested all of the available upscaling settings on this static scene. So we start at native 1440p at 45 FPS, 1440p DLAA, 42 FPS. Now, as you said, John, that kind of like correlates with what you'd expect, right? A performance hit for extremely high-end anti-aliasing being attached to that 1440p image. However, now things start to get weird. 1440p DLSS quality mode, 46 frames per second, a 1 frames per second improvement over native 1440p. And it's using, like, I think it's 67% internal resolution. Something's not right there. And it continues. You know, you can go to DLSS performance mode, which would be internal 720p. And on this scene, we hit 61 frames per second. But, you know, there are much more challenging scenes in there. And then you compare to FSR, right? And FSR quality mode, bearing in mind we got 46 FPS on DLSS, FSR quality mode is 76. The scaling there is kind of more in line with what you'd expect. Now, I would also expect DLSS to be lower, but not to the extent where it's like 30 frames per second lower. And it's to the point where in order to beat FSR quality mode frame rates in DLSS, you need to be using DLSS ultra performance mode, which is an internal 480p. This is nuts versus internal, I think, 964p on FSR. So first takeaway, DLSS doesn't seem to be working properly in terms of upscaling, which is a real problem when you're using something like a 4060, because this is how, you know, lower-end CPUs and indeed the current gen consoles stay in the game, right? Mm-hmm. By upscaling, because, you know, the developer's focus is moving into quality of pixels, right? And you pay for that quality with lower resolution, but you upscale to make up the difference. So it's actually quite interesting, because when you're using the 4060, you're so used to using DLSS that actually you're finally aware of what it's like not to have an equivalent NVIDIA card, because you've got to use FSR, and it's not great. That's the crazy thing there. Let's talk about FSR, because it is. IO has attracted a lot of negative comment based on the fact that it's using a static library baked into the code, as opposed to a DLL that could be upgraded to FSR 4. And it's a valid comment. And I did actually ask IO Interactive about that choice. And it basically, comment reads this: the lack of FSR and XeSS support at launch comes down to development time constraints. Due to the upgrade in the renderer's core after Hitman, we had to re-implement the upscaling options. Since the non-DLL FSR 3.1.5 implementation is the one we needed for the console builds as well, prioritizing that was the logical choice for us. We are investigating if we can add FSR 4 and or XeSS in a future update. I think, you know, that's it explains why it's happened, but I think ultimately the PC version needed a bit more care and attention in that regard, especially when DLSS is in there. So, you know, all of the inputs for XeSS and FSR 4 are being prepared, right? Because it's very similar inputs across the board for these upscalers. But only DLSS is in there, and DLSS is in there and not working. Initially, there were conspiracy theories that, you know, NVIDIA was, because it was sponsoring this title and adding features like path tracing further on down the road, it was like, okay, well, they're disadvantaging AMD. Well, I can tell you, as a you know, if I was an RTX 4060 owner, I'd be very, very unhappy with 007 First Light. So that argument does not really hold true. So that's the situation with upscaling. And I think there's another thing which irks me slightly, is the lack of dynamic resolution support. Because John, in your video, you were showing these like really, really nice volumetric effects, right?
Yeah, they're awesome, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The issue is that in the PC version, whenever you see those effects or, you know, effects along those lines, you get like a hit to performance, which I suspect what's happening on the consoles is, well, you know, no problem, we'll just adjust dynamic resolution. Mm-hmm. And job's done. But on the PC version, running at the equivalent settings to the PlayStation 5 performance mode, you do see a hit to performance there. And I've only just been looking, you know, you can see it in stuff like the big fight at the end of the training montage. Mm-hmm. And even in Q's lab, you know, a plume of fire pops up and suddenly you're losing performance. I'd have really liked to have seen dynamic resolution scaling in there for those that want to, you know, optimize for a specific frame rate. Yeah, so, you know, for the 4060, do I really need to be engaging a 2x frame gen in order to get over 60 frames per second? I don't think so. I think, you know, I've just disappointed that it shipped in that state, because it's obviously you know, it's the first thing I noticed as a 4060 tester, so to speak, and owner, that, you know, some things are amiss here. We should be getting much, much closer to the console experience, and we're kind of not, because the performance isn't there. But it is if you use FSR, so, you know, tricky. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the CPU side of things actually seems to be pretty good. There are minor dips below 60 with the Ryzen 5 3600. I suspect it's down to the streaming system, similar to what you saw, Oliver, in the chase scene that you highlighted in your video. I actually then, you know, the following day, just before this direct, I decided to go back to that system and to replace the 4060 with a 5060 Ti, which is quite a leap in terms of graphics performance. And was using DLSS quality mode at 1440p there, which, you know, doesn't save you a lot of performance over native, to be honest. But, you know, you do get better anti-aliasing than native. So that was what I chose to do. 1440p 60, mostly attainable. But again, whenever those volumetric effects pop up, then we're below 60. So that's kind of not great. I can't help but feel that the PC version was deprioritized here in favor of the consoles. The consoles, John, I think the consoles are actually pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I was genuinely shocked at just how well it turned out given that state of play. That's why I included that comparison, because there were some actual, you know, some minor changes, but by and large they got there, and it's so stable and smooth. And even on the base consoles, it's like not as smooth as Pro, but like 99% of the way there. That's really great. I actually, you recall when I mentioned in the comparison how I was curious about the windshield, right? I showed the windshield reflection in the demo, and then it's gone. One of the IO guys actually messaged me about that on social media, and basically said that was actually just one of their normal planar reflection mirrors that they use in other parts of the game, but it actually was too heavy for that specific scene to hold 60 there, so they axed it. So it's funny that so it was not RT at all. I was just wondering if they had implemented that, because they already are doing software RD. They could have done that with the a reflection pass as well, but no, it's just the planar reflection mirror, which is interesting.
Can you remember if that mirror effect is in the PC version on the higher settings?
Oh, I haven't checked. That's actually, I need to play further to actually see that on PC, because I played through it on consoles, but still need to check it out on PC. That would be interesting if it's actually there.
It would be interesting because the consoles, pretty much all of the consoles, even Series S, are using medium quality reflections. So I'm curious if there is actually some scalability there that, that could replicate that missing reflection.
Indeed.
So, you know, my sort of takeaway on the PC version is that the thing is, I would call it an entry-level GPU at this point, a 4060. The first thing you do when you load up a PC game is to basically set an initial baseline for performance, right? You know, you want 60 frames per second, so you start to make changes to resolution and upscaling effects to get there. And you kind of, you know, I was in the privileged position of having access to the settings choices that IO Interactive made for the game. And I could see that something was wrong straight away in terms of like expected performance levels with DLSS. It's really difficult for me to imagine that with all of the interested parties involved in this, like NVIDIA and obviously IO Interactive itself and its QA departments, etc., that this wasn't like highlighted and fixed. I'm sure it will be fixed. But you know, if I'm on an RTX 4060 or, you know, a 3060, these are the two most popular GPUs on the Steam hardware survey. You've kind of got to guarantee that things work properly there for that amount of people. And of course, when you make those changes, it will improve the situation for all of the NVIDIA owners as well, not just that. Oliver, curious about your take on this.
Yeah, I mean, it's an unfortunate situation because if you look at this game, to get where they are on consoles, they have to push really hard in dynamic res. Like, obviously, we have the tables here that IO Interactive has provided, but actually, in my own practice on, like, PlayStation 5, it seems more often close to 720p. That's going to 4K using FSR 3.1.5. That's a really heavy upscale, and some current generation games are obviously in a similar boat. Some aren't, and perhaps the ones that aren't would not be as affected by something like this. But a game that's already going to 720p on a PlayStation 5, probably you'd want that to be, you know, I regret to say it, at 720p on similar PC hardware, which an RTX 4060 very much is, largely. So the fact that you also have to rely on FSR 3.1.5 on PC on that same class of kit to get an acceptable visual experience without frame generation, it's a serious concern. But at least, you know, you're not necessarily in a worse position relative to the consoles with respect to that upscaling treatment. It's just that you're not used to getting that kind of somewhat substandard upscaling experience on premium NVIDIA hardware, even at the lower end, right, of the spectrum. You're used to getting that nicer DLSS4 presentation, typically speaking. It's not an amazing situation, but I think that, weirdly, actually, maybe the best upscaling experience with this game currently is on PS5 Pro, where it has PSSR, seems to scale pretty well, has dynamic resolution in the mix. It's usually, like, I think I counted about 1000p in my tests. That's a pretty positive situation. And image quality, I mean, it's not perfect. People have commented on the game's image quality in PS5 Pro, saying it looks a little bit soft. I don't necessarily disagree. But I think it is a superb-looking image relative to that base machine. Mm-hmm. And it sells the credentials of the pros, I'm sure John saw in his technical analysis, where, you know, it's not objectionable. It looks really, really good, actually, on a 4K set, even close-up. Holds up very, very well. Even hard to pixel count in some scenarios, which is always a good sign of a good upscaler, as much as it foils my machinations there with pixel counting. So I'm happy with the state of the game on consoles, and perhaps with a couple steps here on PC with regards to that scaling behavior with DLSS, perhaps it could be equally strong on PC relative to the expectations.
Mm-hmm. Pixel counting machinations. I love it. Sort of painting you as some sort of Machiavellian figure. Anyway, yeah, I'm going to be looking forward also to Rayan's PC analysis, because there is scalability upwards based on this settings table, right? You know, unfortunately, it seems to be mostly in the volumetric fog quality and volumetric effects quality, which I kind of understand now why they're at medium based on my PC testing, because it seems to be pretty heavy. Anyway, we will be coming back to that, of course, and the Xbox video should be with you imminently. But with that, let's move on. Right then, well, we have had an official announcement from Activision that Switch 2 is going to be receiving Call of Duty Modern Warfare 4 day and date with all of the other versions. In fact, there was a big reveal yesterday at the time of taping this, where the basics of the game were revealed. There seems to be big technological improvements here. There's a return of the campaign to the single player sort of iteration that we'd prefer over the co-op that, stuff that they tried to introduce last time around. No last gen is reconfirmed, so to speak. Oliver, curious what you make of all of this. I mean, Switch 2 day and date, that's good.
It's ambitious. It's ambitious, and it's interesting, because we've seen from other developers that have tried Switch 2 day and date, including the aforementioned IO Interactive, that actually shipping a Switch 2 version day and date in line with other contemporary current-gen console hardware, not the easiest thing in the world, but obviously with the studio as well-resourced as, you know, the various Activision studios. And I think it's being handled external to the traditional Activision Studios family here. They have a lot of resources to deploy on this one, so perhaps I shouldn't be too surprised. But I did take a look at the trailer that they launched, and I think it looks good. But Call of Duty cinematics and gameplay can be quite different, and we didn't get any kind of extended look at the gameplay here. I'm not sure what it's running on, but on PC they are talking about new ray tracing features, which is super exciting, I think. And not just in like some cinematics or in the multiplayer, but actually during the campaign. They're talking about ray traced reflections, AO, shadows, and volumetrics, which is like a piecemeal, like it's not like they're ray tracing all the game's lighting necessarily, but it does look interesting and quite good. Indeed, in this footage, I was able to see some pretty firm evidence of RT reflections with clear and correct off-screen reflections of things like characters or lights in a convenience store, things like this that are a little bit hard to capture with other reflection techniques, other techniques for specular lighting. My expectation on current-gen consoles would be maybe something that's a bit more of an iterative step above the other titles, but it really depends on the extent to which that ray tracing suite is deployed on consoles. The only time we've seen Call of Duty games use ray tracing on consoles was 2020's Black Ops Cold War, which used RT shadows. So perhaps we'd see something similar here, although that's probably a lower impact RT effect relative to the other things. In terms of the rest of the game, I am encouraged by a return to the single player format that was so important to Call of Duty for, you know, over two decades, and they kind of discarded with last year's iteration. I was not a big fan of that. Hopefully there will be no Warzone maps here. Hopefully it'll be pretty good. I'm a little bit more sensitive and a little bit uncomfortable with the game's plot, which, you know, Call of Duty is always like this kind of power, Western power fantasy thing that's going on, but involving real world countries and things that are pretty thin representations of actual real world leaders and military conflicts like this. I'm always a little bit sensitive to that kind of stuff, but I mean that comes with the territory of this series and what it's generally doing and what they generally try to represent. But you know, I'm pleased with this overall. I mean, it does seem like I'm not sure exactly how large of a technical leap it will be, because Call of Duty is an annualized franchise, so we tend to see more iterative technical upgrades instead of something like IO Interactive, where they're upgrading like their entire technology stack for the new title. But I am encouraged to see at least the adoption of RT, which historically has not been a high priority for the Call of Duty team, right? It's been something that some teams have approached with kind of an open mind. Some teams have kind of discarded in favor of more traditional rasterization techniques. In this case, it does seem like they are embracing it at least pretty wholeheartedly on the PC version. And I think that probably indicates a direction of travel for where they want to be. Maybe not on current-gen consoles, perhaps, but certainly next-gen consoles and going forward, that probably indicates their kind of direction of travel when it comes to these advanced rendering features in the Call of Duty engine.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, in terms of like the iterative upgrades, I think it goes in kind of like two potential directions. I think new Call of Duty entries do tend to get technological upgrades depending on what the designers want from the engine. But we sometimes get like big technological increases, boosts, revisions of the IW engine, for example. I guess the last truly major one would have been Modern Warfare 2 back in 2019.
Right.
Where there was a lot going on there. And I'm hoping it's the latter for this one, because it's kind of like what we would expect by this point, you know, 7 years after the last major tech upgrade. Kind of makes sense at this point. But at the same time, I think they do have to remain scalable across a lot of systems. And that's kind of why we are able to get a Switch 2 version day and date. I guess, you know, possibly some of the sort of optimizations that would have been done for last gen, they can pick and choose from those. I guess they also, you know, just like everybody else, they want to have their game playable on a wide, and I mean a super wide range of PCs. So it's sort of like the same sort of effort involved. Looking forward to this. Hopefully we'll have some more details on this soon. I'm guessing there'll probably be something in the summer event season about this. John, are you optimistic about Call of Duty based on, well, the lack of optimism from prior series entries?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I hope that this actually delivers. I always, like I say, I always enjoy those campaigns, unless they suck, which sometimes they do. I liked Black Ops 6 campaign. That was a pretty good one. So in the Modern Warfare 1 and 2 reboots, I thought did a really nice job with it as well. And I think the theme here is interesting and different from something they've done before. So, and it looks visually good, like really nice in this trailer. And I think you're right on that. The optimizations they would have done for last gen would be perfectly applicable to the Switch 2. So I don't see that as anything unusual or crazy. It makes sense, actually. It's great to see it launching alongside all the other versions. Somehow I'm reminded of playing Call of Duty Black Ops 2 on the Wii U at launch, though. I don't know why. Remember that?
I played that version quite a lot, actually. It was not so bad. The campaign was a little rough, but the multiplayer was fine.
Yeah, I recall it actually runs, I think, worse than the triple, though.
Right.
which that's not good for a brand new console at the time. But we'll see how this actually shapes up, and hopefully it's good on Switch 2. So The only thing I would argue is that I feel like these types of games don't play well on handhelds. Even if you ignore the multiplayer, like when you're playing the campaign, for instance, unlike, say, a Halo or something, or Doom, these are focused on long distance enemies, right? You see small enemies in the distance, you're taking them out from a distance with long range weapons and aiming down sights. And I feel like small targets on a small screen aren't that fun. So, you know, but obviously Switch 2 is also dockable and should be perfectly fine there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess we're going to learn more soon, and I can't wait to find out about it. Okay, let's move on. So there have been some rumors about this, but it has actually come to pass. CD Projekt Red has announced that there's going to be, remarkably, a new expansion for The Witcher 3, Songs of the Past. Mm. I mean, you know, the game's over a decade old at this point. The concept of producing a new expansion for The Witcher 3, on the one hand, you know, it's kind of like, well, you know, that's kind of crazy, right? But on the other hand, I think it's going to do extremely well simply because the game is kind of almost evergreen. John, I'm curious what you make about this.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's interesting that they're revisiting it at this point. I guess the weirdest thing for me is going back to a project that seemingly had a pin put in it for years. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They got to essentially go back to this old project that, I mean, they have fairly been upgrading it, to be fair, right? But still, it's interesting to return to that and then create something new. But I'm actually excited now, because famously this is a game I did not enjoy or was unable to enjoy for years until it finally like just clicked when I was recovering from sickness, and I ended up playing through like every bit of content in it and put like 300 hours into it. It was ridiculous. And I really, really, really enjoyed that world and those characters, and I'd love to revisit it like this, since I suspect it'll still be a while before we see the fourth entry. So, yeah. You know.
They're also, of course, remaking the first entry, but I suspect that's still years down the road.
I forgot about that, right? How odd, yeah. Okay, yeah, I'll be curious to see. I will say, though, that the expansion packs that The Witcher 3 had are among the best expansion packs I think I've seen in a modern game. Like, they were really, really compelling. Like, everybody talks about Blood and Wine, which is a whole new region and really, really compelling. But the first one was also, like, a really compelling piece of DLC. Really enjoyable quests and stories there. So, yeah, cool stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oliver, what do you make of this?
I think it's cool. It's cool to see support for games extend this far, because historically that's been the prominence of, like, MMOs, games like World of Warcraft. But in this era where games are costing hundreds of millions of dollars, even into the billions in some cases possibly, it's not such a bad idea to take a look at an older game that might have even lighter production requirements than a current generation title and revitalize it with new content, especially in advance, possibly, of like an internal delay for a title, who knows, but like for a title like The Witcher 4, which might not be out for a little while now. Possibly there is a good track to keeping gamers sated with new content for a title like The Witcher 3, and I wouldn't be surprised to see the same approach taken with a title like Cyberpunk 2077. I know they've indicated that they're putting a pin in that one, but that title has an enormous fan base, and people still love to play it to this day. And I could definitely see it receiving some kind of major patch or new content infusion. It seems like every year or so they kind of go back to the drawing board and issue a new major patch for that title, even though they indicate with every major patch that it's likely to be the last one, right? They do seem kind of intent on continuing to bring that game up to modern standards, and I would not be surprised to see new versions of that game or indeed new content down the line. But you know, it's interesting, they're pruning legacy PC support, like they're cutting out the DX11 renderer, cutting HDD support, and they're massively raising the spec floor for the CPU and GPU. On the GPU side, they're going from like a GTX 660 / RTX, or not RTX, I guess 7870 at that time, the AMD 7870, Radeon 7870, and they're going all the way up to GTX 1660, which is like, on paper, that's like 6 or 7 years more advanced in terms of GPU hardware. But obviously, you know, I think people won't complain too much, because the spec floor in that was kind of criminal relative to modern PC expectations. And I actually think that almost no one will be excluded by this new minimum spec. And in any case, I wouldn't be surprised to see it continue to run fine on platforms like the Steam Deck, which might even be notionally below that minimum spec, right? Because these things are a little bit more fungible these days than they used to be. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think it's a cool kind of project. And I wouldn't be surprised to see maybe other players in the gaming industry take a similar approach to their long-running, very popular titles.
That's an interesting idea, yeah. I mean, I'm not sure there's too many Witcher 3s out there.
No.
That could fly, but you know, no. Maybe a few. I can't see Rockstar going back to Red Dead, for example, or GTA 5 at this point, but... man, yeah, interesting. Yeah, those boosted specs that you were talking about, I think it's fine. Mm-hmm. Right, the CPU requirement, minimum CPU requirement. So I'm guessing that's sort of like 30 frames per second. You'd never know because they don't tell you here, seemingly. But, you know, a Ryzen 5 2600, I think that's like a eight or nine-year-old CPU at this point. Same with the i5 8400, I think. Yeah, GTX 1660, that would be kind of like 2018, 2019-ish. Mm-hmm. Radeon 5500 XT. I mean, that is not like a super, super powerful GPU. So I think, you know, we're going to be okay there. yeah, there's some confusion about the whole Windows, which version of Windows you'd need. There was concern that Windows 10 wouldn't work, but I think that's just CD Projekt Red acknowledging that Microsoft doesn't support Windows 10 anymore. I don't see any reason why it won't run on it as such. Yeah, interesting stuff. I mean, I was hoping to see some sort of footage by now, but apparently not. We've got a promotional image and that's it.
Well, it did seem like this was leaked unintentionally, so I'm not sure they were planning on talking about it so soon. Yeah, possibly here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. Okay, well, let's move on. Right, so recently I put together a video showing PlayStation 3 emulation running on the PlayStation 5, and one of the games I wanted to show, of course, was a game that's effectively locked to the PlayStation 3, Metal Gear Solid 4 Guns of the Patriots, but not for that much longer, because the Metal Gear Solid Master Collection Volume 2 is going to feature a new version of Metal Gear Solid 4. And there was recently a live stream that actually showed nearly an hour of MGS4 gameplay. Oliver, do you take a look at that?
I did take a look at that, although this is perhaps more up John's wheelhouse than mine, but it does seem to indicate the game running on a PlayStation 5, or at least they're using PlayStation 5 controllers here, and it is running at a stable 60 frames per second at a reasonably crisp output, at least as far as you can judge from a pretty low-quality 1080p YouTube stream. I think the encouraging sign here, though, is that this game is obviously a very complex game, you would presume, for emulation purposes, possibly, at least here. And I'm not sure exactly what kind of solution they're using here, but it does seem to be running at a consistent 60 FPS, which is always actually within the remit, as I'm sure you're aware, of the original PS3 version. It's just that it was running with a double buffer VSync setup that usually put the game at 30 FPS or even 20 FPS at times, but it could get all the way up to 60 FPS. Indeed, we're seeing that realized here. I think it does look, you know, there's certainly an appeal to MGS4's visual look. I think some elements have aged better than others. The character models still look quite extraordinary, but they also have a very plasticky look with more basic skin shaders than we're used to seeing in modern titles.
Right.
But it is a really important game, I think, in the progression of graphics technology, and it's a very pretty title, and it certainly indicated, I think, it was one of the very best looking games when it came out at the time, I remember. And it's obviously a game that represented something pretty incredible in terms of cinematic achievement. I don't think there was any game really like it before or arguably since in some respects. And I'm encouraged to see it running so well on a PlayStation 5 unit, although I'm sure John has, you know, stronger interest in this perhaps than I do. I did play it back in the day, but I don't know that it would be a top priority of mine to replay. I think the game has some issues here relative to prior series entries that did not make it quite as appealing for me. But cool game, and I'm glad to see it come back in an official form, finally, after almost 20 years.
Yeah, I think ultimately just the concept that it's no longer locked to the PlayStation 3, that you are going to be able to enjoy it on a range of systems, is a major win. I wasn't a massive fan of the game myself, but John, what's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm also, I don't love this one compared to some of the others. I think they went, basically, after the first two chapters, it just kind of, the gameplay momentum runs out and they get too far with the cinema stuff. But I still enjoyed it a lot at the time. And I am at least excited to see it, like, revisited and running smooth on new hardware. I don't think this is emulation. I think it's an actual port to modern hardware. And up until now, like, there hasn't been an easy way to experience this in the modern era. You can run it on RPCS3, but getting it to do so requires a lot of tweaking, and it's still a gigantic pain in the butt to get anywhere near an optimal experience. And then, of course, the triple itself doesn't run great. So I think it's cool to see it. Everything about this so far seems to be on point. They've even kept, there was stories going around, they've kept the original iPod in there, which is funny, but I'll be curious if they replace the podcast. I remember Ryan Payton did some fun things with that original podcast on there, but I think it would be fun to revisit that as well and, like, add some new episodes, like, from a modern perspective, you know, coming to this game all these years later. Like, what, 20 years later? No, it's less, 18 years later, I guess.
It's a while.
Something like that. It's been a while.
Mm-hmm. I've just been watching the stream, John. I've just got to 42 minutes, 55 seconds. And there's a guy showing his ass running away at gunpoint.
Oh, no. That's the whole Johnny Sasaki diary. Like, I could have done without the diarrhea jokes, I have to admit. It's not, okay. And they, you know, this was a reference to the original Metal Gear Solid that they did this in, but they went way too far with it in this. Like, it just keeps coming back. I mean, he's pants up into, like, the end of the game or something. And then they try to make a whole story reason around it, 'cause he didn't take the nano machines or whatever to, like, help deal with the anxiety during combat. And so, like, he's, like, always, like, freaking out. And it's a thing. Okay. It's interesting, though, even though the stream is low res and it's within a box, you can kind of get an idea that it might be running at 4K when you look at the shadows, right? Because on the emulation as well, the shadow maps directly scale with the internal rendering resolution. And when you compare it to the original game, it does look like a pretty massive boost in terms of shadow map pixel count, suggesting that the internal res is way, way higher. Could be 4K, actually. And it's cool that they scale because it makes the shadows look way better, obviously. But this is very much like of the era, and I don't think that's necessarily bad. This is before we got into the era of like trying to simulate global illumination or anything like that. It was still like a remnant of the Doom 3 era, if you will, where you have these really stark, like light and dark areas with really sharp shadows, not stencil shadows like Doom, but it was this like super heavy contrasty look with like deep shadows everywhere and lots of normal maps he used to add detail. And I think as a remnant of its time, I think seeing this sort of presentation in high resolution at a smooth level of performance has a certain charm to it, right? I do think this holds up a lot better artistically than stuff like Gears 1, for instance, like early Unreal Engine 3 stuff, which was mind-blowing at the time, but it's doesn't look good now, I would say. This sort of visual design has aged much better.
Yeah. I mean, there was the piss filter, of course, during that particular generation, but there was also the brown filter, and this seems to be more in the
latter. It changes. Yeah. Every chapter has a different color filter, right? Like, you get the blue filter in one chapter, you know, that. I also want to see how they handle the... There's a few things that I'm still wondering about. One, there was the installation stuff, and there's like a lot of fun references in there, and I wonder if they're going to like integrate that in some way. Two, I still want to see how they're going to handle the videos, because there are, even though most of the cutscenes are real time, there are some video based ones. So there's that. Also, there's the PlayStation 1 stuff, right? When you first get the Shadow Moses and it's like actually like designed to look like the original PlayStation, then he sort of wakes up from that dream.
Right.
And which, I again, curious to see what they do there. Like, there's just a lot of little, like, this game is so weird. Like, they did so many little tiny details, and this is the kind of stuff that does make Kojima games fascinating to me. But there's just like attention to detail poured in like the weirdest spots. And that also extends to just like the guns themselves. Like, there's an obscene amount of weapons and things and detail about all of them in this game. Like, the systems are actually so dense that they're more dense than the game's level design can actually support, right? Like, I feel like there should be significantly more gameplay in this than there is when you consider how much like density and quality there is to the core mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm hoping that lessons have been learned from Master Collection Volume 1 in terms of, you know, stuff like resolution and stuff. So hopefully we will be seeing not just performance increases, but resolution increases too. Yeah, I get what you're saying about the shadows there, John. It does kind of indicate that it is going to be improved. I think that's the right call. Yeah, we will be looking at this as soon as it's available. But as an early preview, I guess at least the performance is there, because as you say, the only other way to play Metal Gear Solid 4 at 60 frames per second does involve RPCS3 on a PC, and not just RPCS3, but also a very, very competent and sort of higher end CPU to get the job done there in terms of emulating SPU, which isn't an option, as we saw in my video on PS3 running on PS5. So, good stuff.
Yeah. I do suspect, by the way, John, I know you mentioned the video sequences. I do suspect, based on an earlier trailer, that the video sequences are probably not changed because they're still running at 30 FPS, at least in the initial trailer. And they do seem to have like low quality depth of field, a lot of aliasing in there. I wouldn't be surprised if they're versions of the original render, which wouldn't be surprising. I don't think there are there that many pre-rendered video sequences. I mean, there are some with like the codecs and stuff like that, in like the motion graphics.
Mostly not, but that big ultra long sequence with the boats at the end of chapter 3, where, you know, you got Ocelot doing the finger guns.
Right.
It's like a 45 minute cutscene. Like, it's insane how long that is. But like a big chunk of that is video, and I assume it's just like they show so much stuff happening all over the place that they just couldn't do it in real time at the time. So that's a video, but you couldn't really tell back on the PS Triple because it had the same image quality as the real-time graphics, and because of the Blu-ray, They were able to use a really high quality codec, so it looks like ultra clean. I'll be curious to see if the Blu-ray mentions get through it as well. If you recall, and stuff like the cell processor and whatever, like they reference so much stuff in here. It's crazy. Now, the ultimate Easter egg, for Rich and I at least, is if they found a way to get a cameo of Chad Warden in here. Like if he pops up on the codec, and it's just like, oh my god, it would be so good.
Man, is Kojima even actually, he's not involved with this.
He's not involved in this.
Who knows?
I'm sure they're not aware of that, but it's still, I can dream.
Absolutely. Okay, let's move on. Okay, next news story of the week. Well, not so much a news story as rather an explainer, because obviously last week we put out our first two videos on 007 First Light, and both were PlayStation orientated. And I think it's worth explaining to the audience why Xbox coverage was delayed, because it's happening a lot with various games. And yeah, it's worth talking about the challenges that we're facing in getting the coverage out there. So in terms of like the first video that Oliver put out, which was PlayStation 5 / Pro, obviously in an ideal world, we'd have liked to have put out the Xbox analysis as well at the same time, because that's typically what we do. We weren't able to. So I think it's worth explaining what's been happening recently with Xbox code that has made things a bit more tricky than usual. And the situation is this. It seems to be the case that for a lot of games that we're receiving pre-launch, we typically get a code, but in order to run the game, we need to have our specific consoles whitelisted by Microsoft in order to boot the game. Now, in the past, this has happened, but it was only for games that were already on the store that were receiving current gen upgrades, for example. So I think going back to the mists of time, I think Control Ultimate Edition required whitelisted consoles way back in the day. But what's changed now is that it seems to be pretty much any game that's coming out on Xbox consoles prior to launch. And basically, it introduces an extra delay. And John, in the case of 007 First Light, we got the game like very, very late in the day anyway, right?
Yeah, I mean, to fair to them, like we got the code on Friday afternoon, when Oliver was asleep, essentially.
Yeah.
And since Oliver was going to get Xbox, you know, we needed to submit those codes or the IDs of the Xbox to the system. But then it was a 3-day weekend, right? So of course they're away for 3 days and not expected to work. So basically, it's like Tuesday is the earliest, and the whitelisting never actually got done. It's just that the game came out, and then they were able to just give us code after that, right? So, and, you know, obviously, we do buy stuff sometimes. We don't mind doing that at all, but for pre-release coverage, we can't do that, right? We need these codes to get that, and we're not, you know, we're not guaranteed anything, right? It's just, it sucks for Xbox coverage and people that want to see what the Xbox is doing because of this whole new system that they put in that's showing up. And it only seems to apply to third parties, by the way. So,
right. Yes.
But it just delays coverage because you can no longer just get the code. It requires the publisher then to jump through a bunch of hoops to get this stuff even confirmed and working. Right. And I think this is bad for Microsoft as well. Like, why would they implement a system that essentially disincentivizes from people from playing an Xbox version pre-release? Because that's kind of what this does. Because it's just more hassle for everyone involved when you could just get a code for another system without any of it. And I think they should consider changing it, just not just for convenience, but to just ensure that there's more people that desire to play on Xbox. Because before this, I would say Xbox was the easiest to redeem because it was the one console that didn't have region restrictions on code activation.
Yeah.
And also typically tied directly into your PC, right? So you would just be able to access all of that right away, and it was great. But this whitelisting system really sucks. I don't think it's a good idea for them. and I hope they get rid of it.
Yeah, I think the other thing about it is that sometimes we don't receive Xbox code at all, and we do go out and buy it. But yeah, I think there's potentially the fact that they're using this system, which basically, you know, the publishers are thinking to themselves, we'll just give out the PlayStation code instead. It's a lot less hassle for us. We don't need to whitelist specific Xbox consoles for every single games journalist that's going to be reviewing this game. So it's, you know, I'm not sure quite why this change was made, but it's clearly having an impact, and it's not good news, right? Because, you know, the other thing, of course, is that I think, you know, some people in the audience who sort of see the coverage roll in from Digital Foundry are not quite aware of how long it takes to make a video.
Mm-hmm. Also
so,
true.
You know, it's the case that we need time to make this Xbox video. And, you know, so I think we're planning to produce it for publication shortly after the publication of this Direct, right? But, you know, that's quite a long time in the perception of the audience. It's like a week later than the PlayStation one, but it's completely out of our control on this front. And I just hope that some changes are made there, because it's affecting the visibility of Xbox as a platform. And I think that's not a good thing to do, especially if you're Xbox. Oliver, thoughts?
Yeah,
you were roundly attacked for not covering Xbox as though it's your fault.
I don't mind. People just don't understand. They don't understand when we get code, which in this case was late. I think 4 days prior to embargo, very late, over a weekend. For God's sake, very
not holiday weekend.
This
is another thing which I'd like to point out is that, you know, it's really not good news if you're spending 5, 6, 7 years on making a game and then you give reviewers 4 or 5 days to review it. This is like really not good.
Right. And I just think people are not aware, like, yeah, we get the game late. It takes that long to produce a video normally. I'm working and trying to get this finished. And I'm hoping to get Xbox code. I was saying to Rich, like, maybe we just do PlayStation. Maybe we get Xbox in there. Like, what do we do? I submit code to them, you know, 12 hours later than I got the request or whatever I submitted to my Xboxes. And that's unfortunate. But also, I would note, not to put any blame on anyone in this situation, but we didn't get code on Tuesday either. And Tuesday was a working day. And I didn't get any code on Tuesday. So this is it's adding a lot of latency. A lot of latency to this whole process, and it's just kind of miserable for us, because we do want to produce the content that you guys want, and if possible, I would like to produce comprehensive content. I've in the past I've prioritized one platform or another for time restrictions, and perhaps that would have been affected here as well, but my intent was to produce a comprehensive, or at least, like, you know, including all the consoles, as comprehensive as I can be. And that wasn't possible with this game. But this is unfortunate. I think it'll drive late coverage of key games or no coverage of some titles, because we just don't. There are so many games coming out. We have so many things to do. And if they don't want to give us code in time, I mean, I can't promise that we'll be there with a video. I mean, I hope to have coverage on every major game, but maybe it goes in DF Direct. Maybe it goes in some other format. Maybe it goes in social media. I don't know. Because I can't keep up with this stuff if we don't get code, right? And I think it's a counterintuitive policy. It doesn't make much sense from a IP protection, leak prevention perspective either. Because Sony will give you code and it will run on anything. It will run on any console you're logged into. Obviously, they have their security measures and such, but I mean, that's still a substantially freer policy than Microsoft. And PC code as well. It's not locked to my PC. I can play it on any PC. Even if it's pre-release, even if we get a game 2 weeks ahead of release, we can play that on any PC that's desired. So, you know, I mean, ultimately people might say this is a small hurdle, but in the realm of producing these videos, we're working on very short timelines, not always possible to produce an Xbox video under these circumstances, or at least a video that includes Xbox. So yeah, in this case, we are producing a video on this game. We are going to get the content out, but it will be late. It will be delayed. I have to work on multiple videos in the interim. Remember, I have like multiple directs to produce per week now. Like, there's so much stuff to do. If Xbox isn't coming in, sorry. Like, it's outside of our control in this case, and it's outside of our control in many cases. And indeed, like Rich said, publishers sometimes just aren't sampling Xbox code, because why would you need Xbox code if you have PlayStation code? And for most reviewers, that would be a perfectly fine system. For us, it makes things harder. So it's unfortunate. I hope to see a resolution of this issue. And if it's like some new platform policy thing, I hope that Asher Sharma is possibly listening and would do something about it, because it makes our life harder and makes you know, I think they do want coverage of Xbox code. I do think they want to see it running alongside PlayStation code. But that's not always possible in this world where we're getting code super late after release. Not a great situation for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's all we really got to say about that, unless you've got anything you want to add, John, before we move on.
Nope. I mean...
No, I think it's just the case that we wanted to get out there why this seems to be happening a lot at this point. And it seems to be an entirely logistical thing. And I'm sure there was some sort of decision made to move to this system at some point, but no explanation was ever made. But it's clearly, you know, a friction point. It's a pain point that hopefully can be resolved. Anyway, let's move on. Okay, as usual, we're going to be looking back in time for the end of this particular Direct to, usually we go 10 years in the past, but for this one, we're going 5 years in the past to see what Digital Foundry was doing back then. I think the key thing, the big release at the time, way back in 2021, was the release of Ratchet & Clank on PlayStation 5, one of the few PlayStation 5 exclusive games, certainly for the era. Got a couple of observations from the DF supporters here. Anxiously chronoed figured, hey DF crew, it's been 5 years since the latest Ratchet & Clank game, and I feel it's still one of the best looking items in the PS5 library. Also, it's got an excellent haptic feedback implementation, and its PC version is nicely optimized. How do Insomniac do this? Molson says, hello DF, exclamation point. I've been replaying Ratchet & Clank Rift Apart over the last few weeks, and I'm continually astonished at how good it looks, even 5 years later. Funny enough, the image quality on the base PS5 is a bit softer than I remember, but perhaps I've been spoiled now by PSSR. Switching back to the Pro resolves this, and turning all the ray tracing options to high almost feels like a preview of what PS6 could be. Excited to see what Insomniac does with Wolverine! Exclamation point. Cheers. John, you looked at this one back in the day, and... man, Insomniac were at the top of their game, right?
They really were, and they still, I mean, they really did good work supporting the PlayStation 5 and have managed to somehow keep a release cadence that feels comparable to the old days. You know what I mean?
Right.
They're able to produce a good amount of games in a reasonable amount of time with excellent tech that look and run really well. And this was definitely a big step for them visually, I would say, because this was one of those first games that used to show off the whole SSD thing, if you recall, when it was revealed. And so obviously they definitely utilized that here. I guess one of the things I remember is when it finally did come to PC and we tested it on a mechanical hard drive on like a mid or lower spec PC, and it was like barely functional. That was quite enjoyable.
Yeah, that was fun, wasn't it? Yeah.
So, yeah.
I liked the tweet from Insomniac. See, told you.
So that was cool, man. And I still think it's a great little game. Great visual design, great characters. It's pure Insomniac, I would say. And then I guess we got Spider-Man 2 not long after that. A couple of years after that. I can't remember the exact timing. But and then Wolverine coming soon, so... good on them, man. Insomniac's one of the best studios that Sony currently has, I would say. They've been very, very efficient at producing good games that sell well and feature great tech.
Oliver?
Yeah, I think Insomniac's been hitting it out of the park. Ratchet & Clank Rift Apart was one of the first games that really made you stand up and take notice. Like, hey, we're in a new console generation. We're doing some exciting things. You know, it featured... advanced ray tracing, which was really cool at the time, you know, ray traced reflections. And the game is like so synthetic and so awash in glossy glass and metals and plastics and things like that. Looks super cool. Definitely stands out there. Really cool cinematics, really cool action, just a fun game, amazing animation work, incredible portal sequences, like John mentioned, that take advantage of the PlayStation 5's advanced storage systems to do things that we kind of only have really seen from Insomniac. Like, there were some of those sequences, similar sequences, in Spider-Man 2, but certainly Ratchet & Clank was an innovator in that sphere, and we've not really seen anything too much like that from other developers. And it had great gameplay, good image quality too, stable 60 FPS on PS5, and stable 60 FPS with ray tracing, which I'm not even sure, I can't remember maybe it was the first title to ship with a 60 FPS ray tracing mode on PlayStation 5. Possibly. I mean, the Spider-Man titles would have been up there as well. I think they received 60 FPS ray tracing modes after launch, performance RT modes.
I have a story about that in a second, Oliver.
Okay. But yeah, it was just an extraordinary game, portended great things for this generation, and indicated, you know, you can actually do some pretty cool ray tracing on the consoles, even if they're not ideally suited to it, perhaps because of their RDNA2-based architecture. But you can still pull off some great things in the consoles. So, great title. PC version also was, I think, pretty good in the end. Worked out pretty well. I covered it, I think, on Steam Deck. It was running all right on Steam Deck, which is pretty cool. Would thrash HDDs. Not recommended there. Would thrash, like, eMMC-based storage or SD card-based storage, things like that.
Ooh,
but pretty cool game. Yeah, would I think Rich had some testing, and it was like, I don't know, dozens of seconds to load between those portals on an HDD. It was a long time. I don't know how long it was, but it was a long time.
It was a disaster. It really was. It was not great at all. I think the other thing which I tested on there was I got hold, once the M2 expansion bay became available, I got hold of the absolute worst possible PCIe Gen 4 drive
right
to run in that bay. It was a real, I mean, everything that, you know, the transfer speeds were bad, didn't have any DRAM cache on it. It was a disaster of an SSD, but crucially, it was PCIe Gen 4, therefore the PlayStation 5 would accept it. And, you know, the benchmarks weren't particularly great on it, but, you know, you could run Ratchet and Clank on it, and it was actually running very, very well on that particular SSD. And I think that sort of was sort of like the point where I began to realize that the whole story solution that Sony has put together for that, it's not just about the SSD, right? It's about the decompression that's available, the hardware-based decompression for getting those assets off the SSD and into a usable form for game data that's also key to it. And I still think in terms of like using, you know, fully tapping out the hardware, I think there's probably a lot of legs left in the SSD compared to what we've seen so far. Certainly, you know, when you look back at Mark Cerny's presentation for the hopes and dreams for the SSD, it was all about, you know, being able to import a huge amount of data, you know, mid-frame, you know, generate mid-rendering a particular frame or having that particular data ready for the next frame. Hugely sort of ambitious stuff. I'm not sure we've seen that sort of fully sort of explored. Maybe it's something for the next generation. But yeah, I mean, this was a fantastic game. And I echo your points about ray tracing, Oliver, because it was the case where going into this particular generation, we kind of, you know, understood what RDNA 2 was capable of versus the NVIDIA ray tracing, and it was falling short, right? We weren't expecting great things on ray tracing on the consoles, but Ratchet and Clank, any of the Insomniac games, they received ray tracing upgrades and they were good. You know, the ray tracing in Marvel's Spider-Man was awesome, right? So yeah, interesting times. And I guess the prolific nature of Insomniac, I mean, we will get Wolverine this year, which is great, but, you know, they've been such great servants to all PlayStation 5 hardware across this generation. You know, they went back to add additional features to Rift Apart for PlayStation 5 Pro. I think that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, some might say they didn't need to do that, but they did. All of their games, you know, their latter, and actually no, the original Ratchet and Clank for PlayStation 4, they brought that to PlayStation 5 and updated it. Yeah, and that was actually really difficult because I understand that the code was locked to an older SDK version. And being able to bring that to PlayStation 5 with any form of upgrade would have been very, very challenging, but they did it, right? So I guess, you know, we're starting to see fewer Insomniac releases for PlayStation 5, but only because they've kind of run out of legacy games that they can actually substantially upgrade at this point. But even so, they're continuing to deliver the goods and looking forward to Wolverine. Any final thoughts, John?
Yeah, I wanted to mention a couple fun things about it. Firstly, and Oliver reminded me of this, when we first got review code for that game, there was an RT performance mode in it that was unintentionally left active. They would go back and add it officially, right? But pre-launch, it wasn't supposed to be there. They were just experimenting and like actually getting to grips with it, right? But it wasn't done, but it was left in by accident, and then they patched it. So like at first I was like, wait, what the heck? Like there, like nobody knew about that at the time. I was like, there's an RT, you can do 60 FPS with RT. It wasn't completely stable yet, but like it was there. It was very odd. And then I actually messaged them about it and it's like, oh, actually that's not meant to be there yet. We're still working on that. Right. And then it did show up later, but they just weren't done, which I thought was very, very funny. There was also famously a lot of social media discussion around this, and I don't know why, but I saved a post from a guy on June 8th, 2021, who made the claim that Ratchet is 100% releasing on PS4, and a lot of people will be rethinking things they thought were only possible with the SSD. Sony is just keeping the illusion going a little while longer. It will look best and be faster on PS4, but it's possible on PS5, but it's possible on PS4. And basically, I think I made a bet with them that said, I'll check back in a year and we'll see what happens. And they never responded to me because I actually did come back to them a year later and said, so what then? And now here we are like five years later, I guess, and still hasn't happened, never happened. So I would like to acknowledge that I won that bet. So okay. That's a fun one.
It's another one of your classic, needless to say, I had the last laugh.
I love those
anecdotes.
I love those anecdotes. So it took a long time. Now, we talked about 5 years ago, but there's a couple things I wanted to talk about from 10 years ago because I think it's funny. Do you remember, Rich, I did a video on APB Reloaded?
Right, yeah.
And we titled it, Is This the Worst Xbox One Game? And it was essentially like a continuation of the Lichdom Battle Mage lineage of videos. And I don't know if you've seen that in a while, but my goodness, that was something gnarly at the time. So if you haven't seen that before, go check that out. It's very funny, I think, or at least it used to be. Maybe not anymore, but that was a bad game performance-wise and game-wise, I guess. It also reminded me that 10 years ago is the time when we finally got Mirror's Edge Catalyst, which was one of the games I was most hyped for at the time. But ultimately, while I do like it, it was kind of a letdown compared to the original with that weird open world structure they did. But I'll grant them, it was a beautiful game, and they did deliver 60 frames per second on the console versions, albeit at a rather low resolution with not great image quality. But still, very cool to see it. And then back then as well, Rich, you did like an insane amount of videos on the GTX 1070. Like
counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and the benchmarks.
Okay, so that's all it is. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, just to explain to everyone, I think we have said in the past that Will's put together a website for us that just shows us the videos of the week 5, 1, 5, and 10 years ago. So yeah, we can reminisce on all of this good stuff. But GTX 1070 was just awesome. It was just basically the days where you could have your cake and eat it. You could have like the prior generation flagship performance in much more efficiency, and you would get it much cheaper. So yeah, the Titan X or whatever, the last generation Titan before that, you got that level of performance in a 1070, which was just really, really cool. I think it had something like 150 watt TDP. It's just like crazy times, the likes of which we're not going to see again. But happy days. Other stuff, yeah. I mean, I think Tom was looking at Overwatch, which wasn't particularly exciting for us at the time. Lessons learned.
Yeah.
But yeah, good stuff. I mean, I was also just quickly looking at 5 years ago, and we're looking at the 3080 Ti and 3070 Ti, and this was kind of like in the midst of the extreme pricing area of graphics cards, yeah, which I guess we're kind of seeing again to a certain extent at this point. 3070 Ti really wasn't very good. It was barely any faster than the 3070. Which preceded it. It's like maybe about 5% faster. They wanted $100 extra on the MSRP, which you probably wouldn't be able to get anyway. It would be a lot more expensive than that. 3080 Ti, basically, you can consider that like a 3090 with half the memory. Came out a year later, approximately, and it just, again, the performance bump versus the 3080, not particularly impressive, but, you know, a huge amount more money needed for that. It just wasn't great. And I think the pricing, the MSRP pricing of the 3080 continues to dog NVIDIA because it was such a great bargain at the time.
It was. Yeah. Oh, what about the Intel Core i5 11400F, which you called...
I think I gave that to your son.
Is that the one he's using?
Yeah,
that's amazing. Yeah, for exactly. I helped my son build his first PC, and I asked Rich if he had any spare parts lying around. And he's like, oh, I got this, and gave it to me. Good. And he's loving it. But it was a really fun experience to like go through that whole process of, I used my old Fractal case before my current one, and I had some other parts lying around, and we just kind of like cobbled together a pretty good PC that plays the games he wants to play just fine. And it's still humming along great. So, and it was a good learning experience, I think. So, and I also, nice. I still have him do things like, it's like, all right, it's time to clean your PC. So we haul it out of the room and take it, strip it down and clean out all the dust and, you know, trying to teach him maintenance on PCs as well.
Amazing, amazing scenes. Okay, well, that's it. That's the end of this particular episode of DF2Ed Weekly. So please do like, subscribe, share, on the off chance you enjoyed it. Ring bells for notifications, that kind of thing. DF supporter program, patreon.com/digitalfoundry. Yeah, support the team. Get early access to DF2Ed Weekly, ad-free website, ad-free videos, high-quality video downloads, updates from the team, amazing Discord community, all good stuff. But that's all from us on this one. I guess we'll see you soon in the Q&A show. But for now, thanks for watching and supporting Digital Foundry.